Hello, and welcome to a special episode of The Lancet Oncology in Conversation With, in honor of International Women's Day. I'm Allie Landman, the deputy editor, and today I'm joined by Dr. Mara Kurgiu, professor at Imperial College London and a consultant surgeon in gynecology and gynecological oncology, to discuss her essay on innovations in gynecological cancer and global disparities in care. The essay reviews clinical advances and challenges in care for five genital tract cancers, including cervical and ovarian cancer, highlighting the importance of prevention and early detection for improving outcomes, as well as disparities in access to high-quality care in low-resource settings. The essay also emphasizes how structural inequalities, including a lack of political will and financial investment, as well as cultural stigma and the social status of women, can impact care. It is these topics I'd like to focus on today. Thanks for joining me today, Mara.
Well, it's a great pleasure to be here, and I'm very pleased about this work and how this essay, I hope, for Lancet Oncology will bring out all the priorities and the challenges that we have to face at the moment in gynecological cancer care globally.
So your essay that's publishing today at the same time as the podcast does a really great job of summarizing some of the advances in diagnosis and treatment of gynecological cancers, as well as the remaining challenges, especially in low resource settings. As a gynecological oncologist practicing in London in a high resource setting, what are the most common obstacles you see for women obtaining care for gynecological cancer here?
I think it's a great question, particularly because I sort of see women's cancer care globally almost being polarized in two separate worlds, as I call them. And I see that there is great inequity in the access of cancer care and control in high-income countries and low- and middle-income countries, which is, as we know now, referred as to the cancer divide. And I always believe that when you actually try to address those challenges in a particular cancer in the same way across those two almost separate worlds, it is almost impossible to tackle them together. And you have to be aware of the setting. You have to be pragmatic about what can be achieved and what kind of changes you can make in each different setting. I think we're probably going to discuss low and middle income countries later. And I think the challenges in high income countries, like here in London, are very different. I think there are many challenges, particularly around the area of prevention, of uptake of screening strategies, and in early diagnosis of these cancers. And unfortunately, most of these challenges affect women from low socioeconomic classes, minorities, for many reasons that we can explore: access to healthcare, language barriers, education issues. There's generally poor knowledge of the symptoms of cancer, sometimes even difficulties within primary care in identifying cancer symptoms, particularly for rare cancers. And of course, I think one of the biggest problems is the stigma and the embarrassment that women have when they face symptoms that may be related to a gynecological cancer regarding their bodies and whether they should or no or not seek some medical help. And I think within high-income countries, there are still lots of migrant women, ethnic minority groups, which have less knowledge about screening and vaccination. People that migrated into the countries, and lots of religious and cultural barriers, for example, for cancers like cervical cancer that are related to sexually transmitted infections. Outside prevention, screening, and early detection, I think for clinicians, there are also challenges. I think the UK in gynecological cancers, for example, is running for many years now a centralized model of care that promotes, high quality surgical care, systemic treatments, and a holistic care for these cancer patients. But even with this centralized model of care, there are tumors that are rare. There are treatments like fertility sparing surgery, for example, for cervical cancer, ultra-radical surgery for ovarian cancer, that are trophoblastic disease that are uncommon and should be possibly supra-regionalized in centers where the volume can increase. That means more expertise from pathologists, diagnostics, from surgeons, from oncologists. But of course, that has challenges in terms of infrastructure, distance for the patients and their experience. But I do strongly believe that in high-income countries, more centralization can promote high-quality surgery, diagnostic, systemic therapies, and the access to new technologies. And many of these new technologies actually have a high cost, but increasing volume can offset that cost and offer the best outcomes to our patients.
Farah, for your personal view and suggestions for how we can improve things, you know, in the UK and other similar countries, I think you bring up two really important points, both about making sure that we're aware of vulnerable minority populations that, you know, are not receiving the same care potentially or the same access as those that for example, are of a higher socioeconomic status, and also the ideas of idea around treating rare cancers and centralizing that care to improve that. Thank you. So you mentioned at the beginning of your essay that cancers that primarily or exclusively affect women have been neglected or overlooked. In what ways can this affect care and outcomes for patients with these cancers?
Well, I think, as you mentioned, cancers that affect women have been neglected compared to other diseases. And there's a lot of cultural stigma that is attached to the genital tract diseases overall and their symptoms. So I think it's very important to target those cancers and try to elevate the status of women, make this a priority so that we can reduce the disparities that we see in cancer outcomes, both within high-income but also low-income countries. I think there have been certainly major improvements around the way we prioritize women's health in the last few years, but we're still, I think, playing catch-up in many societies that still remain patriarchal. I think I was in a charity event last week, and I was looking at some data that I can't quite remember at the moment, but I was thinking when I was reading the amount of funding that is given for prostate cancer as opposed to endometrial cancer that the event was about. And it was a huge difference. And I know that there has been work from the Lancet Commission on women and power in cancer. And generally, it is becoming more and more known that women's cancers are relatively underfunded compared to their incidence and mortality. And of course, if you don't have funding to do research for a cancer, if this is not a priority as an area of research, that immediately translates in less ability to detect prevention, screening strategies, and early detection, in less research in identifying risk factors, genetic groups that are at high risk, and less, I guess, funding to tackle and find strategies to reduce the risk and identify the disease and treat it well early. And I think the lack of funding or making this a priority can hamper our ability to develop new approaches for early detection and novel diagnostics and new therapies. I think at the same time, we should always keep in mind the challenges and the cultural stigma that is associated with that area. So the research and the work that is done should also prioritize that element. For example, we've seen low uptake of screening as women do not turn up for the cervical screening, and how strategies like self-sampling in those people that do not attend for screening can have a major impact for women that neglect that aspect of their care. So I think we need to continue to try to implement education programs for women, enhance their engagement in the community, continue to train the local providers, particularly in primary care, because some of these tumors are quite uncommon. And as such, the symptoms that they present with are quite vague and sometimes mimic other conditions. And I think we should also try our best to use digital technologies, integrate telemedicine, integrate new surgical tools, and try to optimize the care for these women.
That's a great point about research funding, and it's not just needing more research funding, but also more research into areas that can really make a difference for the people that aren't getting the care that they need. So importantly, a lot of the issues that we're talking about here seem to apply to gynecological cancers, but not to breast cancer. Breast cancer is more common, but in some ways it shares with gynecological cancer some of the sociocultural taboos that can make it difficult for women to seek and access quality care. So what role has advocacy had in setting breast cancer apart from other predominantly women's cancers?
I think someone would think that they're very close, those cancers, but actually I don't think they are that close. I think breast cancer is the commonest female cancer, and campaigning advocacy for breast cancer has been a public health priority for a very long time, probably admittedly because it's a very common cancer. But this led to screening, it led to patient education about self-examination, promoting attendance for investigations if you feel a lump in the breast. And this, together with existing screening that most gynecological cancers, for example, don't have, apart from the cervix, it has led to a success story in enhancing early detection of this cancer. There is, however, a breast screening program available for breast. We only have that for cervical cancer in the genital tract. I think those campaigns were very helpful for breast because women are encouraged to do self-checks. They're aware of their own bodies. They're less and less ashamed to seek medical help if they find a lump. This awareness made them more compliant with screening. And I think the pink ribbon to breast cancer has almost become a brand of its own, a symbol of how you can destigmatize this cancer and get women the help that they need. Now, if I go to the genital tract cancers, I don't think it is the same situation at all. I think the symptoms that women present with when they have gynecological cancers, the regular bleeding is an area of taboo. I think the removal of genital organs is also a very important stigma for some cultures. I think that some cancers like cervical cancer have been associated with sexually transmitted infection, which is some people evidence of religious issues, cultural issues, and of course that has impacted on vaccination rates. There have been anti-vaccination campaigns with sometimes an inability to control what information goes through social media. And this is why I think we have a great opportunity to do things for genital tract cancers for women. I think we need to destigmatize HPV virus vaccination and screening. In some countries, it has still a negative association with sexual promiscuity, and it's deeply harmful for prevention. I think symptoms like bleeding or change in bowel habits are also symptoms that many women would avoid presenting to a doctor or a new vulva lump for vulva cancer, particularly when this happens in older individuals. And of course, there is no screening for ovarian cancer. There is no screening for endometrial cancer. And it's important that apart from patients, there's also education of primary care providers in those symptoms that quite commonly can mimic other gastrointestinal diseases and tumors, such as we see in ovarian cancer. And similarly, the bleeding irregular patterns can be almost part of normal process of perimenopause and menstrual changes with age and hormonal preparations that women may take. So it's very important that all of these areas will be addressed. And I do find that there is a difference for genital tract cancers as opposed to breast.
In the essay, you discuss structural and socioeconomic barriers to treatment of gynecological cancers in economically disadvantaged regions in high-income countries and in low-resource settings in low-income and middle-income countries. How do these economic, financial, and political barriers to cancer care disproportionately affect women, and specifically the care of women with gynecological cancers?
It's a very interesting question. It's a big question as well. I think there is certainly a growing incidence in these cancers. And I think this is due to increase in life expectancy. There's expansion in urbanization. There have been changes in our lifestyle. There is a global epidemic of obesity. And many women present late, which means we see more and more advanced disease that is translated into poor survival outcomes, particularly in those disadvantaged group within the high-income countries, and particularly also, of course, in low- and middle-income countries where there's no access sometimes to any early detection investigations or prevention. I think in high-income countries like the US and the UK, for example, we see that ethnic minorities, Black and Asian women, and socially disadvantaged women have some of the highest risk factors for these tumors. High rates of obesity, diabetes, metabolic disorders, which means higher rates of endometrial cancer, lower uptake of cervical screening, language barriers in taking in all the information about possible symptoms and the importance of screening, and of course, institutional racism that sometimes affects the diagnosis and treatment. I think in low-income countries, the social status of women continues to be quite low. Many women are relying financially in male parts of the family to support them during the process of being investigated and the stigma associated with that. If we move now from prevention and early detection, I think in surgery itself, there is what we call the surgical chasm between high-income and low-income countries. In high-income countries, we're refining the robotic surgical techniques, when in low-income countries, over 5 billion people do not have access to a basic surgical procedure. I think this migration of skilled doctors, surgeons, or anesthetists, and there is a difficulty in creating the model that organization that you need and infrastructure to be able to offer basic cancer surgical care in countries where there is financial instability or even political instability. Over 23 countries with over 200 million population have no access to radiotherapy. Many countries do not have access to even generic chemotherapy. And I think it is important that we take all of these aspects into account when we think of how we can help and redirect the spending in a way that we can tackle some of the most important issues. I think although advancement in technologies is very important, it is also equally important to see how we can reorient some of the money that we spend in things that may not have a big benefit and are non-evidence-based to minimize over-intervention and over-treatment when this is needed, and redirect those funds to the people that need them the most.
Yeah, I really like that point that you made in the essay about perhaps it might be too much to ask in some settings, in some situations, to put more money into something, but it might be easier instead to redirect and say, well, where you're putting the money doesn't make any sense whatsoever. So just take that same money and put it somewhere evidence-based that's really going to help people.
I think we said that it is probably utopic to call to reorient the spending in sophisticated weapons to women's health, but it may be feasible to reorient funding spend on low-quality treatment and non-evidence-based devices to redirect it to something that will make a huge difference to people's lives.
So finally, what are the one or two most impactful things that could be done to improve outcomes for patients with gynecological cancer in the next 5 to 10 years, in your opinion?
Well, I think that's a difficult one because I need to choose one or two. So
you can even say five, but it's a time limit rather than a number of things limit.
No, I think I know what those are. I think for me, the elimination of cervical cancer, as this has been noted by WHO, is actually achievable. We have the tools in our hands to eliminate cervical cancer. And I think this is why the WHO put this one as one of their major targets by 2030. I think global vaccination for HPV will have a major impact in reducing this, not just cervical cancer, but also other HPV-related malignancies. And I think availability of the vaccination strategies to ensure that all suitable individuals globally, not just in high-income countries, have access and are vaccinated will make probably one of the biggest impacts, as it is cervical cancer is a cancer that affects young women. So the years of life lost is substantially higher than other cancers. The impact on families, on maternal orphans, on the communities and the economies from death from this cancer in low-income countries is still a major burden. And I think that vaccination, given the infrastructure that screening requires, which is probably unrealistic in those settings, should be one of the biggest priorities. I think also that there is a lot of new discoveries in terms of identifying high-risk individuals through genetics, and a lot of efforts to see whether low-cost, high-uptake tests can be used in the future to identify high-risk individuals and try to develop risk-reducing strategies. I think, and I don't want to go into each one of the cancer separately, we've seen advances in the way we treat our cancers, advances with systemic therapies, both in endometrial and ovarian cancer, which have led to improved outcomes. But I think the most important thing, in my opinion, is to initiate a global campaign about women's lives count. A global campaign that will mimic what we've done in breast cancer, for example, and other big social issues. And women's lives and health will become an equally important priority for funding and research and optimization of treatment. And I think there's an ever-increasing burden from disability and premature deaths of women's cancers. And we should concentrate and focus our efforts to tackle them, prevent them, treat them well, offer access of care in low-income countries. And this will have major benefits for our communities and our economies.
Great. Thank you so much. Thank you for speaking to me.
It has been a pleasure.
You can read Dr. Kurju's essay online now at thelancet.com. Thank you to Dr. Kurju, and thank you for listening. You can subscribe to the Lancet Oncology podcast wherever you usually get your podcasts.